Good morning, Chris Aberle for Chalita Wilson. She's here appealing the district court's denial of her motion to suppress. One of the two aspects of this appeal is her claim that there was no reasonable suspicion allowing Detective Dillon to stop her car. Detective Dillon was called by the manager of the Home Depot, who told him about a woman who had come in to purchase a gift card, and while she was waiting for management to come and approve the transaction, she decided to leave the store. Nothing particularly strange about this event, except that a month or two earlier, a woman, also an African-American woman just like Ms. Wilson, had come into the store and purchased two gift cards worth thousands of dollars, and it was a fraudulent transaction. We believe that under these facts, there's no reasonable suspicion to pull her over. The government, however, has a completely different set of facts, which raises an issue of which facts this court should consider. Specifically, the government says that the Home Depot supervisor, that's the person who was in the front of the store, became uneasy because Ms. Wilson refused to show her identification. She then fled the store, quote, hurriedly, without completing the transaction, when she saw the manager coming.
But why? That's certainly not probable cause, but why isn't that reasonable suspicion?
Why is that not reasonable suspicion?
Yes, sir.
Well, under the government's version, we would, you know, we don't dispute that it would be. But we are arguing that the government is not entitled to its version of the facts in this particular case for the very unusual reason that they're taking some liberties with the record that they're not entitled to. For example, they claim that the front-end supervisor became uneasy because she refused to show her identification. Well, that's not really in the record.
That's not in the record?
Well, what's in the record is this. The testimony about what happened in the store comes from Eric Robertson, the manager. He said that his front-end supervisor was uneasy because this is a transaction worth over $200 and because of what happened 2 months earlier. Somewhere later in the transaction.
Well, how much money had they lost 2 months earlier?
I'm sorry?
How much money had the store lost?
It was either $4,000 or $8,000. He wasn't sure. What he testifies to is in a different context later that he says, and I quote him, and I think she even told me the lady didn't want to give her a driver's license number or show the ID or something to that effect. In other words, it's not clear what she did regarding her identification, and one thing is for sure, it was not the cause of the unease of the front-end supervisor, but that's a minor point. The biggest problem is that the government relies on the testimony of Detective Dillon as to what happened inside the store. He wasn't there. He is not particularly competent to say what happened in the store, particularly when we have the testimony, the very contrary testimony of Eric Robertson, who was in the store and who did know what happened. He's the only source of any information that Detective Dillon had. And
why shouldn't those conflicts be resolved in favor of the court's conclusion?
Three reasons. First, there's no findings of fact made in this case.
Well, they are implicitly, aren't they?
Which facts, though? I mean,
well, the facts that support the judgment.
Well, let me begin by saying that there was no specific factual findings made for sure. There was also the judge who made this decision, unreasoned decision, was not the judge who presided over the hearing. So he's not making any credibility decisions. So we don't really know which facts he, you know, did he believe, did he find reasonable suspicion based on Eric Robertson's testimony? How can you know? And then, of course, the government is entitled to facts, you know, viewed favorably to it, since it was the party who prevailed. But in this case, we would argue that doesn't mean they get to have Detective Dillon's facts when he wasn't there. And not to mention he's got a motive to shade the testimony to justify the legality of his actions. And Eric Robertson, the eyewitness, he's got no particular motives. And under Eric Robertson's testimony, contrary to what the government says in its brief, and to the extent that this is what Detective Dillon says, he did not see this woman except from behind. This woman did not see him. She did not turn around and look at him and then and run out of the store. He did not believe that he was the woman. She was the woman he saw in the surveillance video. He just thought, well, it could be. What did he have? He had a woman who was an African-American who was of similar stature. And that's all we have. Basically, we have a woman who changes her mind during a transaction and leaves the store. If this, you know, we would argue that that's the version that this court should look at. And under that version, there's no reasonable suspicion.
Do you have any authority for that? I've scoured for cases that would be about store transactions and reasonable suspicion, and could only find a case called Raines that was about a pseudoephedrine case, but it wasn't exactly similar. Do you have any authority for what would be reasonable suspicion in this context?
No, and I suppose my research skills do not exceed yours, because I was not able to come up with something like that either.
So we have to basically say that the fact that it could be the same person who did this before, just by the nature of the transaction, a $200 gift card, and the person leaving the store when they go to get the manager quickly and then peeling out of the parking lot, we have to decide whether that's reasonable suspicion for the officer to stop the car. Is that correct? Do we have any other facts?
Well, no, we don't, and I wouldn't even say that you can fairly say she left quickly out of the store based on what we have in this transcript.
I thought it said she walked hurriedly out of the store.
Well, that's what the government says.
Okay.
Mr. Robertson, you know, says she walked out of the store. When asked one time on cross-examination, well, how did she go? Did she hurry? He said, I believe his testimony was, little quick pace. She walked, no running, no jogging or nothing like that. And then he was asked, so she just walked out of the store? Yep, she just walked out of the store. And this is a woman who's sitting there waiting at the cash register while the cashier tells the supervisor about needing approval, because it's over $200. We don't know if it's $8,000. Apparently it's not.
She wouldn't be the first person who got frustrated waiting in the store and took them too long and to just say, I'm leaving.
I would assume not. And then she's waiting for the supervisor to go across the store, interrupt a meeting, tell the manager she needs. And the manager says, can it wait? She says no. Then he comes out. She explains it to him. He decides, okay, I'll go see what's going on. And he walks back across to the front of the store. When he's 50 feet away, he sees her at that point leaving the store. She's on a cell phone. At some point, she's on a cell phone when he sees her leaving. So, you know, did she get a phone call to leave? So we don't know. Now, she speeds off. Well, she's not driving this car. She gets in a car that takes out of the parking lot at a quick pace. Now, that is the testimony, a quick pace. And, you know, what does that mean in this case? She's got no reason. She's sitting there. She's presented herself to the supervisor. She's presented herself to the cashier. She's changed her mind about committing this crime.
But she wouldn't show her ID.
Or something like that.
That's not suspicious?
Well,
you get $200 out of a store without an ID, it's pretty slick.
Well, as I said, this manager saying, she wouldn't show it or didn't have it or what, something to that effect. That's the best he came up with. And maybe this is, well, you know, okay, darn it, don't have my ID. Forget it. I'm leaving. Okay, does that mean she was about, that she just committed a crime?
But the question is not whether there is a construction of the facts that would make her conduct reasonable. The question is, from the lens of these defendants, they have reasonable suspicion of what they perceived, correctly or incorrectly, what they reasonably perceived. Why isn't it reasonable for them to read these facts that she was up to something and that she quickly got out of here when the employee went to the authorities, which would perhaps uncover her misdeeds.
Well, we would argue that, first of all, she didn't pick a particularly noteworthy time to leave. She was there while they were getting a manager. So there's nothing suspicious about the timing. Obviously, she at some point decided, I better just leave.
Made a phone call.
I'm sorry?
And made a phone call and got into a car and took off.
Well,
so there's somebody else driving.
Correct. And I don't, I'm not sure why that's suspicious at all.
Well, she didn't get in her own car. She makes a phone call. If I'm looking at this transaction, I'd say that she quickly moved out. She made a phone call, quickly got out of there, and a car appeared, and she gets in it, and they speed off. Now, that's one way of looking at it. And why the question is it reasonable to put that, not whether in some ultimate truth that's act what happened. You can have perfectly innocent conduct that gives cause to reasonable suspicion to you agree with that, don't you?
Yeah, well,
that is your argument. It was perfectly innocent kind of conduct.
But I would add too that we're adding facts when we say she made a call. I mean, it doesn't say that she made a call. It says she was on a cell phone. So did someone call her again? So, there's a lot of inferences you need to make before you get to thinking, did she just call to have the getaway car come and pick me up? And I don't know that is necessarily reasonable.
Where is the testimony about the ID being requested and her refusing? I'm still not clear on that part of the testimony. Who testified that she was asked to present an ID?
I can grab that for you.
You don't know?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know the page off my top of my head. I do have it highlighted in my...
Do you know which witness said I asked her to present an ID and she refused? Because I can't find that.
Well, it's Eric Robertson's testimony.
And he said that he asked to present an ID and she refused?
No. He's talking about what
the cashier did.
There's a cashier, then there's a supervisor, mm-hmm. and then there's the manager. And he's talking about his conversation with the supervisor, and he says, and I can almost quote it, and I think she even said that she didn't want to give her ID or give her license number or show her ID or something to that effect.
But
okay.
What about Robertson says she made a phone call and I watched her and she quickly went out and I watched outside the store a car pulled up and she got into the car and how did the car just appear to pick her up if it wasn't in response to the phone call? And from their perspective, she is really moving away quickly.
I really do not think that's in the record. I really don't.
You know?
He never says she hurries out of the store.
Robertson said that he drove, I thought, he watched the vehicle pull up in front of the store,
and then
drove into a parking lot and parked. The woman walked to the parked vehicle, got in, and the vehicle sped off. Now, quite
correct.
Clearly, her ride was waiting for some signal as to when she was ready to go.
Right.
And one sitting in the parking lot waiting on her.
Correct. And what if she was, why it doesn't, we're not sure why that's suspicious, I guess is our point. I mean, she could have gone in there and bought a gift card and said, all right, I'm
she
done.
Could've.
Pick me up. We're leaving. Eric Robertson said it was weird, okay? Is that enough to stop the car? That's the question in this case. But on to the issue of consent.
Okay.
Again, here, you know, this, here obviously we have to rely on Detective Dillon's testimony because he's the one who was there to witness this. But even again, you have to wonder if he's not shading his testimony when he says he was trying to exact consent out of this woman for only 10 or 15 minutes when his colleague is saying, oh, it was 30 minutes or more, probably a whole lot more.
Even if we agree with you that it wasn't voluntary, don't you still lose if we find for the reasonable suspicion on the first ground because of the automobile exception?
Well, you've got to get to probable cause.
And you can get to probable cause with the maps and the bad stories and...
I don't think so, Your Honor. You've got... What about maps? There's a map...
He doesn't know the address of his grandmother's house, and they're stopping to get a map.
We would suggest...
And there's no map. And there's no... How would that help if... Never mind.
Well, I would argue that nobody... You know, they said we went to purchase a map. They never said why. And there was, in fact... But there wasn't... See, here's the other thing. There was, in fact, a map in the car. So they absolutely did purchase a map. Now... Nobody says I needed a map to find my grandma's house. And I think the government cites 8 different reasons that probable cause exists. And the only one, if I had the time, I could take every one of them and tell you they mean nothing, except for the fact that this Eric Russell says...
But you didn't raise that on appeal, did you, the automobile exception ground?
You're right. And before I concede ineffective counsel on that, Your Honor, this thought has come to me. We would argue, number one, first of all, it doesn't affect the reasonable suspicion argument. But we would argue that the facts that they rely on largely for probable cause are those that support the reasonable suspicion. We would argue that our argument in favor of that there's no reasonable suspicion implies the greater argument that there's no probable cause. But also note that because we don't have a reasoned ruling, and because we believe the argument that there's probable cause to search this vehicle is so devoid of merit that the district court's unreasoned ruling can't reasonably be said to incorporate a finding of no probable cause.
All right, thank you, Mr. Aberle. You've saved time for rebuttal. Ms. Jones?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Patricia Jones and I represent the United States. Let me begin by just addressing Judge Elrod's question about a case that might concern information from a store. And there was a case that we cited, not in our brief, but to the district court, and we cited it at page 114 of the record, and that was in our post-hearing brief. It was the case of United States versus Keith. And the police in that case had received information from a retailer that a probationer had purchased pipes and end caps, and the police acted on that. Well, the probation office acted on that tip from the retailer in conducting a reasonable suspicion search of the probationer's home. And so I think that is on point and indicates that a police officer can form reasonable suspicion based on information received from a third party, and specifically from a retailer, as in this case. If we're looking at reasonable suspicion, what we need to look at is the information that Detective Dillon had when Detective Dillon made the stop. And the information he had was that there had been a fraud 1 or 2 months prior at the Home Depot. He was investigating that fraud with Eric Robertson, the manager of the store. They had both viewed a videotape which showed that prior incident, and they were both able to see the woman who committed that fraud on the videotape. Detective Dillon had given Mr. Robertson his cell phone number and told Mr. Robertson to call him if the woman ever came back into the store. Well, on June 18th of 2008, Detective Dillon got the call that he had been waiting for from Mr. Robertson. In that call, Mr. Robertson told him, "I think the woman that committed the fraud on the previous occasion is back in the store trying to do it again." And she tried to purchase a gift card with a credit card. I was alerted to it by someone on my staff. When I went to the area to see about it, she saw me and she turned around and walked away at a brisk pace. She then got into a car and left. Mr. Robertson described the car. He said it was a white Chevy Impala. He told Detective Dillon that he thought it had a temporary tag. He told Detective Dillon that he thought a black male was driving and that it went east on Highway 64 towards Plank Road. Detective Dillon proceeded to that area described by Mr. Robertson. He saw exactly what Mr. Robertson had described, which was a white Chevy Impala with a temporary tag driven by a black male, and he thought he had reasonable suspicion of credit card fraud, and he stopped the car. What the defendant would have you do in this case is look at each little tiny piece of information possessed by Detective Dillon or Mr. Robertson and try to give it an innocent explanation. And that is not how this court or the Supreme Court views reasonable suspicion. It is a totality of the circumstances test. You look at all of the circumstances and don't pick them apart and find innocent explanations for each. It sure would have been poor police work for Detective Dillon to fail to follow up the information he got from Mr. Robertson. Now, a couple of things about the record and the findings in this case. As Judge Higginbotham pointed out, there are surely implicit findings of fact made by the judge in this case. The district judge denied the motion to suppress for the reasons given by the United States in the United States post-hearing brief. Implicit in that is acceptance of the facts set out by the United States, and especially those that support the court's judgment. So there are implicit findings of fact, and even implicit findings of fact are entitled to be viewed from the clear error standpoint. So unless this court would have a firm and definite conviction that a mistake was made, those are the facts that we are dealing with, the district court's findings of fact. There's no law that I'm aware of, and I looked for some, and the defense has provided none, that the fact that there was a different judge who presided over the hearing than made the decision influences the standard of review. There is no law cited, and I couldn't find any to that effect. The district court made its findings, it made its decision, and they're entitled to appropriate deference. A couple of things about the facts that Mr. Aberle mentioned I think deserve note. First of all, Mr. Robertson did say that the woman left the store quickly. His words were a little quick pace, and that's at the motion transcript at page 18. Detective Dillon said when he was contacted by Mr. Robertson said she left at a brisk pace. That's at page 24 of the hearing transcript. As far as the car is concerned, again, the evidence was clear from both Mr. Robertson and Detective Dillon that the information was the car had left rapidly. Mr. Robertson specifically said the car sped off, and that was at page 20 of the hearing transcript. Detective Dillon testified that when he got the call from Mr. Robertson said it left at a fairly fast pace, and that's at page 24 of the hearing transcript. The record is clear about her speeding out of that store. Now, Mr. Aberle also represents that the woman never saw Mr. Robertson, and he did not believe that she was the woman from the prior fraud. I do not believe that either of those are supported by the record. First of all, what Mr. Robertson said, and this is at page 10 and page 11 of the hearing transcript, was that when he came around the corner to come up front and see what was going on, the woman had turned and started walking out the store. He was asked, how did you know that that was the woman that you had received the information on? He said, she was at register one. And when I came around the corner, then she turned and walked out. So it's not clear, as the defendant would have you believe, that she was already headed out the door before he came around the corner. The first thing, what Mr. Robertson said was, when I came around the corner, she was there at register one. Then she turned and now, admittedly, he says things a couple of different ways, and it's not exactly clear. You could read it one way or the other. But what Detective Dillon testified is that when he got the call from Mr. Robertson said, when she saw me, she hurriedly left the store. So according to the information that Detective Dillon had from Mr. Robertson, it was extremely suspicious. When she saw the manager coming around the corner is when she took off. And that adds to the suspicious nature of the events. There has not been a lot of discussion We didn't get to that by the defense on the issue of consent. I would point out there is one case that came to my attention in preparing for oral argument that is not cited in our brief. It is United States versus Andrews, and it is at 746 Fed Second 247. It is a 1984 case, and it concerns an incident in which the police misrepresented the purpose of a search, and this court held that the consent was nonetheless valid. And that's one of the arguments stressed by the defense in their brief, of course. In that case, the defendant was located outside of a motel room that the police were searching. The police handcuffed the man and detained him while they were conducting the search. They read him his Miranda rights, and during the course of some questioning, he mentioned that at his home, about 50 miles away, he had a sawed-off shotgun. The police asked for permission to see the shotgun, asked if he would produce the shotgun for them to look at. And they told him that the reason they wanted to do that was to make sure that it was not a gun that had been used in some robberies by a man who met his description. The court in that case found that the actual purpose that the police wanted to see the gun was because they wanted to know if the defendant was the felon in possession of a firearm. And so the defendant, who wanted to clear his name of the robberies, drove the 50 miles to his home, and he was followed by the police. They showed he showed the guns to the police officers, and later he was indicted. And this court upheld the consent. Police officers are not required to tell all of the reasons that they want to conduct a search to the defendant. And in that Andrews case, the court noted that, of course, the police could have had more than one reason for looking. It might have been because of the robberies. It might have also been because of, but even if it was a flat misrepresentation, the consent was not vitiated.
Do you agree we don't have to reach that issue if we find, pursuant to the automobile exception, that you could confiscate the materials?
That is correct, Your Honor. There was probable cause to conduct a search of that vehicle, especially by the time that Detective Dillon had questioned the occupants of the car. There was plenty of probable cause for the search. The defendant has not raised that on appeal. He never even argued it in the district court. It seems clear that there was probable cause, and that would be a reason you would not need to reach the consent issue. Unless the court has further questions for me, that would conclude my remarks. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Eberle, you saved time for rebuttal.
just back again on what this record says. Eric Roberts says, when I walked up to the front, the young lady had turned around and started walking out of the store. I saw the back of her head. I didn't really get a good facial look or anything like that, you know. I couldn't pinpoint her, you know. I just saw the back of her head because when I turned the corner, she was walking out the door. And as she walked outside, she was on a cell phone. Did she rush in a hurry, or did she just walk out of the store? A little quick pace, didn't know jog, you know, or nothing like that. Walked out of the store. Just walked out of the store. Didn't run, no running, just walked out of the store. Didn't turn around and look at you, like the question, didn't turn around and look at you like they were trying to get away from you or nothing? No. So I don't know where in the world you can get the fact that they made eye contact and that caused this woman to run out of the store. It is absolutely true that that is what Detective Dillon says. But how his statement can override the eyewitness in this case, we believe this court wouldn't be able to find.
Let me just read, on a slightly different factual issue, let me read two sentences from the government's brief, and you can tell me whether it's an accurate representation of the record. Hamilton told Robertson that a cashier called her to approve a gift card purchase that was for at least $200, giving a page citation. She felt uneasy about the transaction because the customer refused to provide identification, again, giving a page reference. Is that accurate representation of the record?
Well, it is inaccurate, number one. He says in the record that she was uneasy, but it has nothing to do with the identification thing. Cindy Hamilton came in and told me that there was a young lady trying to purchase some gift cards by register one. I don't remember exactly how much the dollar amount was, but it was over the $200 limit, and they wanted to get a manager involved. She was just uneasy, especially after what just happened probably a month or two ago before that previous thing happened. Now, you flip a page or two, and then he says, talks about how when he was at the staff meeting, et cetera, and was recounting what she had told him, and then he says, she said the young lady was up to the front waiting to purchase some gift cards, and I think she even told me the young lady didn't want to give her driver's license number or show that ID, something to that effect. So,
all right. Well, that's what we need in oral argument is more information on the record. So you've answered my question, Mr. Aberle, and thank you for. We notice, of course, that you're a court appointed, and we always appreciate your good work. How many court appointments have you had in this court? Lots of them. I know.
A couple hundred.
You always do a good job, and we appreciate your willingness to continue serving as an officer of the court.
Thank you.
Your case is under submission.